425-9618. That's Wednesday, March 14th from 3 to 4:30 p.m. Back to Resume Basics here at HFCC.
Hey, hey, this is the Gothabilly Man, your friendly neighborhood beatnik, inviting you to join me for the Recce Hours Rockabilly Psychabilly radio program every Monday from 4 to 6 p.m. right here on the station Making Waves, WHFR.FM.
Join me, LaBeth, here at WHFR.FM. Together, we will enjoy a montage of music featuring various jazz styles, old jazz, blues in jazz, and jazz just as you like it. Listen every Wednesday from 4 p.m. to 6 p.m. here at 89.3 in Dearborn, the station making jazz waves like no other.
Let's declare an International Blues Music Day. Hi, my name is Johnny Childs, blues musician and president of the New York City Blues Society. To support this great cause, please join our Facebook group called Petition to Declare an International Blues Music Day. Join the discussion and let's create a formal day to celebrate blues music. From its legends and pioneers in the U.S. to the continually evolving pool of modern-day blues artists around the world. Let's celebrate our love for this great American art form and bring more recognition and support to blues music for many generations to come. Find our Facebook group called Petition to Declare an International Blues Music Day. This is Johnny Childs saying thank you for supporting the blues.
Hey, it's Brian from the Verve Pipe, and you're listening to WHFR Dearborn.
The following program has been pre-recorded. The views expressed by the participants are not necessarily those of WHFR Radio or Henry Ford Community College. Welcome to We Are Not Alone. We're local investigators, as well as world-renowned scientists and ufologists, share their latest evidence in support of the UFO reality. I'm David Twitchell, and you're listening to WHFR Dearborn. WHFR.FM is the station making waves, and for the next hour, we will be exploring the mysteries of the UFO and abduction phenomenon. And our guest today is Mr. Roger Marsh. Roger is a UFO writer, author, and playwright. As an independent filmmaker, he has written and directed two full-length films and three documentaries. He is the director of communications for both the Mutual UFO Network, MUFON, and Pennsylvania MUFON. He writes articles for the National UFO Examiner and is the editor of the MUFON UFO Journal. And welcome to the show, Roger Marsh.
David, hey, thanks for having me on. Glad to be here.
Very good to have you. As you intimated before we came on here, we have been bouncing emails back and forth for some time, but never spoken to each other.
That's right. Probably about at least 3 years, I know, since I've been writing over at the Examiner.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, it's great to be on your show today.
Thank you. The Examiner. Now, tell us about The Examiner. What exactly goes on with that?
Well, that actually was an idea as an experiment back in 3 years ago, in January of 2009. I was working from a home office, and I was looking for an outlet to be writing about UFOs. When I kind of looked around the country, David, I was kind of disappointed that there weren't any mainstream journalists writing about UFOs.
Mm-hmm.
So I got in touch with then international director James Carrion with MUFON at the time, and said, "Hey, I have an experiment. I'm going to hook up with Examiner.com, and I'm going to write full time about UFOs, and I'll cover it from the MUFON incoming database as people are reporting."
Mm-hmm.
So he liked the idea. I jumped in. And Examiner is kind of set up by market, depending on what city you lived in. And I lived in Chicago at the time, so I became the Chicago UFO Examiner. But within just a couple of weeks, my work became so popular that Examiner got in touch with me and said, "Hey, how would you like to be the national UFO Examiner?" You know, covering stories from across the country. And I think that first year we did about, I'm just off the top of my head, about 1.3, maybe 1.4 million page hits that first year.
Okay.
And it's been about the same, you know, a little up, a little down, you know, over the three. So I just finished my third year writing, and I do cover it as the cases come into a fund.
Okay, now, The Examiner, let's not get that mixed up with the grocery store yellow
right.
rag that I call it, you know.
Exactly. Yeah, The Examiner is pretty widespread as far as the topics that they take on.
Right.
You know, and they're in pretty much every market in this country.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, we're definitely strictly an online publication.
Right.
Actually, if folks just Google my name, just Roger Marsh, just Google it, I pop up first, and you can click and come right into The Examiner and see all the latest UFO landings or near landings.
They're near landings.
Near landings.
Are there a lot of them, or are they just, you know, stories that people toss out there and hope people believe?
Well, yeah, I mean, as you might know, looking at it through MUFON's eyes,
mm-hmm.
you know, we all think, you know, roughly about 90% of all UFO reports can probably be broken down into something natural or man-made. It's that last 5 or 10% that we're looking at. But I did notice that there was a kind of an uptick in the number of reports that were being made to MUFON that seemed to start around Christmas Eve, about December 24, 2011, and kind of continuing, you know, into now, well, for February 1st now.
Hmm.
Also quite a bit of triangle sightings
mm-hmm.
lately.
Mm-hmm.
And if any of your listeners are readers of the MUFON Journal, you'll see that I started a four-part series in the February Journal where we're looking back at 2011. And we're going to go quarter by quarter, you know, looking at just the triangle sightings. So a lot of those sightings, a lot of them very close to the ground, objects being described as just a couple of hundred feet off the ground, some even lower. Nothing landing that we're seeing.
Okay.
But all the current cases, of course, are under investigation. I did note that I believe in the first quarter of 2011, there were 16 triangle cases that were eventually marked by MUFON as an unknown.
Mm-hmm.
And that's pretty much the best we can do in MUFON. If it's marked as an unknown, we've ruled out anything man-made, anything, you know, that Mother Nature might have dished up. And again, we just don't know.
We just don't know. No, I always tell people, you know, they say, "Well, what do you think it was?" You know, I'm an investigator for MUFON, as you know. And,
yep.
And what do you think it was? Well, I can't tell. You know, this was an alien from planet Melmac or something. But,
right.
but it was an unknown. I mean, we just don't know. So,
exactly. It's just, I know that, I mean, people have actually, when they meet me in person or I'm on the phone, that they pull me aside and say, tell me what's really going on.
Well, I wish we knew.
You know, like, it's this big secret that we're keeping.
Right, right.
I really don't know. I'm in it just to be part of, you know, the discussions and the research that's going on. But again, like you said, we can't say, you know, that these are aliens from another planet. There's many different theories. It could just be some other type of intelligent life form that's just always been here, you know, part of Mother Earth.
Mm.
Some people say they're interdimensional beings. There's others with a, more of a religious or a Christian, you know, tie into it. There's many, many, many different theories. I don't rule anything out, personally. I don't know how you operate as a investigator, but I keep everything on the table, you know, and I look at the facts, what's going on, and obviously, like everybody else, I want to rule out Mother Nature. I want to rule out the man-made items, you know, first, and it is interesting with what's left over, that 5 or 10% that we just, you know, where, you know, a case where you have multiple witnesses, the thing came down to, you know, 50 feet off the ground. And, of course, we also look at our own government, and are these some type of secret military craft? I keep hearing that over and over again.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And, you know, you kind of want it to have an earthly explanation. Anything else is a little bit scary. But, of course, I always wonder, why is the military, you know, hovering at this remote Oklahoma horse farm, you know, 50 feet above the barn, and scaring, you know, the person on the ground,
or in urban areas, you know.
Why did they
test fly their prototypes from northern Arizona to southern Arizona in 97? You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, right. The, I mean, we have Area 51 out in Nevada. Come on, why aren't they keeping it out in those areas, if it is us. So
I understand.
I don't know. It does beg the question, you know.
Why aren't they using them? I would say they're way beyond the prototype stage, wouldn't you? If there's a virus.
By 2012, we have enough stories in our arsenal that if this is us, we should be using them right now over in Afghanistan and other parts of the world.
Right.
Because they're very stealthy, as you know. Not just the triangles, but even some of the other shapes. One of the oddities, of course, about ufology is that 99% of the time the witness will say the object was completely silent.
Right. Right, and then it takes off. Zoom, it's gone.
It's right. It could be off in a distance and move to your location in just a split second. It could be hovering 50 feet in front of you, and in the next second it takes off so fast that some witnesses claim that the object just disappeared right in front of them, as though you threw a light switch out.
Right. Vanished,
Or it's just moving at such an incredible rate that the human eye is just not able to see it.
Right. Now, which brings up the possibility of interdimensional or dimensional. That's all I can say.
Right. That's actually my favorite theory, is the interdimensional.
Right.
That they're my favorite theory would be that they've always been here. They're not from other planets. It's more of a natural thing. It's just a species that we haven't cataloged yet, or species.
Right.
And they move in and out of our airspace interdimensionally. That's my favorite description of what we're looking at.
I mentioned,
based on the witness testimony.
Yeah, I mentioned this on the air before. Is that I asked a good friend of mine one time who claimed to be, and I believe him, was an abductee or an experiencer, I should say.
Yes.
Are they extraterrestrial, other dimensional, or extraterrestrials coming through another dimension? And his answer was yes, yes, and yes.
And all of the above.
All of the above. So that's possible, too. But anybody who tells you, I know exactly what these things are, I know exactly what their agenda is, you know, run for the hills, because they don't know.
No one knows.
So tell us what your involvement is with the MUFON Journal. This is a monthly publication.
With the MUFON Journal?
Right.
Well, basically, back in December, the outgoing editor had resigned, and the MUFON board approached me, and they've known me for 3 solid years, you know, as a writer, and they approached me and offered it to me, and I, you know, gladly accepted. And I have since, I think in the month of December, I put December and January out. And then this month, we've put February to bed. And so if you haven't, if you're a subscriber, you haven't received it yet, it's in the mail.
Okay, yeah. That's why I was calling. I'm wondering where my... No, I'm kidding.
Again, if people are up on MUFON, we just had a change in international director, and office is now moving under Dave McDonald's leadership out of Cincinnati, Ohio. And my understanding is the database that actually creates the stickers to mail the journal, that has gone off to Cincinnati. And today is their first official day as the home office. So I would imagine they're scrambling today and tomorrow, you know, to get these out. And,
It's quite an involved process, isn't it? Editing the journal and getting...
Well, it's a labor of love, David.
Yeah, okay.
We have a number of regular columnists, as you know, coming in every month. We have, you know, Ted Phillips, and we have Filer's Files,
right.
And we have, Friedman's column that comes in. We have the Night Sky on the back page.
Mm-hmm.
And those guys are great to work with. They're on time every month, you know, with their material. And the neat part of it is the board has asked me to get back to our roots with the journal and to get more stories in there about actual case investigations.
Right.
So that's what I've been trying to do in these first three issues.
Mm-hmm.
And so far I'm getting good feedback from the board and from across the country. I'll wait a couple weeks to see what they're going to say about February's issue. But so far, so good.
Good.
More stories about actual investigations.
Very good. I've noticed there've been a larger number of UFO sightings in Missouri. Would you consider this a UFO?
Yeah, we had I think that was, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think that was October that we had the large amount of sightings coming out of Missouri. And I know that some of those sightings were traced to a team of aviators that were flying out of a particular airport, and they were... I said stunt flyers. I'm not sure if that's the exact words to use, but they're trained pilots to go out in formation to do certain things. But speaking with the state director out there and the assistant state director with MUFON, the actual people on the ground with some of these investigations, they were able to take a percentage of those reports, and a lot of them were, you know, objects that were very low to the ground, David. And we had some photography, we had video, we had some still digital photography. And if you tracked, of course, the airport and the flying team, they were very easy to work with, letting us know when they took off and from where and exactly where they went, when they returned. So we could match that with all the stories. So we had a lot of those stories out there, according to Missouri MUFON, that did not match when these aviators went out. So there was a little bit of, you know, we had our fair share of hecklers saying that the whole thing, you know, the whole thing was these pilots and just the way the lighting was on the craft, how low that they were to the ground. But again, we were left with, wait a minute, you know, not in these cases over here. And
right.
It was a significant number of them, too.
So the airport actually cooperated with MUFON in this respect.
Oh, yeah, very, very much. I think that they were laughing, I think, from their end as soon as they heard that there were UFO reports being made at the same time they were flying.
Right.
But they immediately stepped up. They took our phone calls. You know, of course, that would be Missouri MUFON calling. And they laid out their schedules. So, yeah, they were very, very easy to work with, is my understanding.
So when you got back with them later, I assume you got back with them later and said, yeah, this one was probably you guys, but here's three other cases that could not have been you guys. What did they say?
Well, did you do that?
It's basically like other cases. They could offer us no explanation. They could look at those dates and times, David, and say, look, it was us that was there. Yeah. We're always, you know, keeping a lookout for hoaxsters, yeah. You know, also. But some of these Missouri cases were so bizarre, yeah. Where these objects were so low to the ground. And I know in one of the instances, if you read the story that was published in the MUFON Journal the following month, I know there were a couple of people on the ground witnessing this who probably were having trouble with just basically time and everything. It kind of slowed down for them. So there might have been some effect of these that these objects had on the people on the ground.
Time for the witnesses, time had slowed down for them? Is that what you said?
Well, it's like you hear this across the country, not in every case, but occasionally you hear that electronics are affected on the ground,
right.
Or you'll have a witness who has missing time.
Right.
So I think there were some of those elements came out of that story that these guys should have reacted this way, and they didn't. They were kind of lethargic about reporting it or reacting when, you know, if something that large came down out of the sky and was hovering right outside your apartment building, I mean, it's one of those pretty wild cases. And it seemed like they were even disagreeing how long the object was there or how close it was or what the time spacing was between photography images. So there was a lot of disagreement and sort of uncertainty that was going on that could be related back to somehow time being affected, which, again, is it's a smaller percentage of cases around the country, but we do hear that in relation to UFOs.
Yes, indeed. Yeah, I need to take a moment just to remind our listeners that you're listening to WHFR.FM, the station making waves. Here in Dearborn, Michigan, 89.3 FM on your radio dial, and WHFR.FM on your computer. You're listening to We Are Not Alone. I'm David Twitchell, and we're speaking with writer and playwright and editor of the MUFON Journal, Mr. Roger Marsh. Roger, you say you are a playwright TV scriptwriter, aren't you?
I've only done independent writing. Yeah, I did two full-length films, which I wrote, directed, produced, and then those were, one was paranormal, one was a straight-out comedy based on a stage show that I had done in Chicago.
Okay.
And then I went on to do three pretty interesting paranormal documentaries at three different sites. Had a great time doing all. I wish I could do that kind of work full time.
Yeah, right. What's the titles of these documentaries?
Well, the first documentary, this one's kind of interesting, is called Tragic Hinsdale House. And I had an overlap with that case. This was a case from 1973 where the Catholic Church in New York State had allowed a priest to go to a site to do an exorcism. And it just turned out that I was a college freshman in 74, the 74-75 school year, at St. Bonaventure University, and Father Alphonse Trebold, who was affiliated with the university, was the priest that did the exorcism. And I was able to hear a talk that he did and then personally talk to him afterwards. I'll never forget Father Al's words when he said that he had gone to this house to do an exorcism, and he said during the actual exorcism prayer that the entire house shook. Now, all these years passed, and I'm in Chicago, and I was watching a Hollywood film about that site and about the exorcism, and one of the credits was a local guy, a guy local to the house that was investigating it. And I managed to track him down, get a hold of him, and speak with him. And he then went to the site, the house, to the current owners, and got permission for me to bring a film crew in. and we were planning to do a documentary. But during the sort of the pre-production months, we discovered that the priest had a tape recorder with him, and he's now dead. But we discovered that he had had a tape recorder, and he had tape recorded the entire exorcism. Mm. And we discovered that somebody had transcribed that, and I got a hold of a copy of it, and I took that transcription and turned it into about a 35-page script. Hmm. I brought regional actors in, and we were the first production company that was allowed to actually be on site, actually go into the house. So part of the documentary is talking to the current people, kind of snooping around the house and looking at, you know, what they say happened there. And then we actually recreate the exorcism.
Hmm.
And the neat thing about that story is while we were shooting the exorcism, the actual exorcism prayer, with actors in place, cameras, lighting, everything we needed, during that filming, that, and again, this is just a recreation of it, the entire house shook.
No kidding.
I mean, it set my crew, actors, everybody running out of the house. And we were quite shook up about it. And, you know, I'm a very grounded type person, and I'm not going to run from anything spooky. And I ask everybody to get back in place.
Hmm.
And, of course, nothing was picked up, of course, on the cameras at the time.
Wow.
But you could feel the entire house shaking and very, very weird. But we finished it. We got out of there a little after midnight that night and went on to finish that one.
Wow. So it must be the reading of that prayer or whatever it is that you read during the exorcism that made the house shake. Is that correct?
Your guess, David, is as good as mine. I have no idea. I never actually tried to come up with an explanation for it.
Mm-hmm.
In my film, if you go to YouTube and just search for Tragic Hinsdale House, it'll pop up. And we did it like a series of webisodes where we released, you know, so many minutes of the film, like, weekly. So you have to watch it in parts. But eventually you'll get to the exorcism. We don't mention it in the film, but on the page, you know, surrounding the film, you know, and I give you background on what happened, I talk about that.
Mm-hmm. It's Tragic Hinsdale House, right?
Hinsdale. Tragic Hinsdale House. Yeah.
How are we spelling that?
And then I went on from there to do two other ones. I had been watching an episode of Paranormal State,
mm-hmm.
and they were at a place in Linesville, Pennsylvania called the Knickerbocker Hotel, and didn't like the episode. I thought that they had kind of talked down to the owners of the hotel. Just didn't like the episode. So I got on the telephone and got the owners on the phone and asked if it was okay if I came in to do a documentary. So I did a nice three-hour documentary on that place. And it's just a friendly, restored, like a 100-year-old hotel in a small town that was restored, and lots of creepy things happening up there.
Did you
had a great time doing that one?
Yeah. Did you experience anything?
I'm sorry.
Did you experience anything during that filming?
I always do a little bit at every site. I know that one of the stories from the Nick is that people who they have what they call the grand staircase.
Mm-hmm.
It goes from the lobby of the hotel to the second and then up to the third floor. And people have said that they've been walking down that staircase and they hear the sound as though a lot of people, multiple people, are coming down the staircase behind them.
Huh.
So that was just one of the dozens and dozens of stories on the place. And here I was up on the third floor, and I'm on my way by myself down the staircase, and I get five or six steps down the stairs, and I hear this clamoring sound. It sounds like multiple people, wooden, you know, hardwood-type stairs,
right.
A little on the creaky side, too, but it sounds like multiple people. It was so loud, David, that I actually moved to the left to let these people down the stairs, but then as I sort of went against the wall to the left, I looked over my right shoulder, and then eventually stopped and actually flipped completely around and looked up the stairs, and there was nobody there.
Wow.
But yet the sound was there, you know, the shaking of the stairs, all of the elements were there as though multiple people were, you know, physically coming down that staircase very hard.
So when you stood still, could you feel the shaking of the stairs as if someone were coming down?
No. At the point when I sort of was coming to the realization that nothing was there,
right. It
just completely shut off.
Wow.
As I turned completely around.
Hmm.
So other than that, was probably my major point that I kind of stopped and went, wow, you know, whatever's causing that, even if it's something, you know, very, very natural with the hotel or the settling, it's weird story.
Yeah, I guess.
I hope it's something natural, but if it's something paranormal, I don't know. I have no explanation for it.
Right. Would you consider, now, they usually put the UFO topic in the basket of paranormal. Would you consider it paranormal or something completely different?
Well, I pretty much do the same thing, David.
Mm-hmm.
I guess the whole topic of UFOs, it's one of those topics that we just don't have answers for.
Right.
And so I tend to just put it into a generic basket called the paranormal.
Right.
I mean, I do it myself. So.
Something that's out of the norm, right?
Right.
You don't see one every day.
It's not in the McGraw-Hill, you know, fifth grade textbook, you know, explaining, you know, right next to Columbus discovered America in 1492. You
right.
know, it's not right there. You know,
and Columbus also saw a UFO himself.
Exactly.
Yeah, he did.
They don't mention that in the textbook.
You noticed that right off, didn't you?
Yeah.
Oh well. So
yeah.
in your travels and in your work with UFOs and with MUFON, which case or cases would you say was the most convincing that this is a real subject that needed further investigation?
Well. You know, I'm not going to be real specific. I'll just tell you that there's a number of MUFON cases out there where I tune into the witness.
Mm.
Because in most cases, 99% of the time, David, we have nothing else to go on. We have no video, no photography, no footprints left behind in the sand.
Mm.
All we have is a person, a simple witness, saying this is what happened, okay?
Mm.
And I tend to look at people that my mind says, hey, look, they look like good people. Why would they be making this up? And I kind of put them on a shelf in one category, and then another one comes along. It's like last year we had it was either North or South Carolina, one of the Carolinas. It was a retired couple. They had just finished dinner. They're in the kitchen, they're cleaning up, and the wife looks into the backyard and said, what are those lights in the backyard? And the husband stepped outside the back door and kind of crossed the yard over to his fence, and he looked, and there was a rectangular object, and this is, I'm doing this off the top of my head, I don't have the report in front of me, but it was like 40 or 50 feet long, and maybe, you know, 20, 30 feet wide was a rectangle. And it was just hovering just 4 or 5 feet off the ground and totally silent. And as he stood there staring at it, the object just sort of tipped itself and up and then like a bat out of hell, you know, leaving the area.
Right.
And I got this guy. I had a radio show at one. I don't do it currently, but I had a radio show called UFO Traffic Report. And I got the husband, you know, on my show. And I had to ask him, I said, when you went back inside the house, what did you tell your wife? How do you explain this? It's cases like that. I had a couple from, they were a Utah couple, husband-wife truckers, but they were in Idaho at the time, and they saw this sphere-looking object hovering, you know, along the roadway they were on in Idaho, off to the left. They pulled their rig off to the right, and they're staring at this thing, and all of a sudden, a cigar-shaped object pops out of it and moves a little bit away from it. It's hovering, And then a second cigar-shaped object pops out. And then those two hover for a few minutes, and then they kind of turn. And again, they just shoot off in, you know, one direction together, one after the other.
Mm-hmm.
And then they look back at the sphere, and it just sort of implodes to a point where it just disappears in place.
Wow.
You know about how many times I've heard that story?
Yeah.
That very similar story.
Yeah.
And I had that couple on my show as well.
Mm-hmm.
And it just can't be that everybody's making this stuff up. I mean,
yeah.
To what point? You know, for what purpose?
Yeah. Yeah.
And it's very simple testimony. This is what I saw. And what gets me are the people that were really close to it. So, you know, one particular case, I'd have to maybe say my own case. I saw a disc-shaped object from about 40 feet overhead. And that was back in 1973, fall of 73.
Okay.
And that was in southwestern Pennsylvania. And we were having a real heightened time. That was the 73-74 UFO spike from southwestern Pennsylvania. I know other parts of the country were experiencing it at the same time.
Right.
But this was in a suburban neighborhood, and a telephone pole in Pennsylvania is 40 feet tall.
Mm.
And this thing was about 5 feet, 4 or 5 feet above that.
Mm.
And it was about the width of a two-lane, you know, suburban roadway. And it just came right toward me, right down the street, moved right overhead. It was following the lay of the land, and it was completely silent.
Right. What shape did you say it was?
That was an oval shape, like a disc shape.
Okay.
And the bottom of it was completely lit up, as I observed at the time. It was the same color as the moon, like looking at the moon.
Mm-hmm.
Same color.
So, but it was not the moon.
It was not the moon.
Moon?
Definitely not. It was, I'm guessing, 44, 45 feet above me
yeah.
when it moved directly overhead. Also completely silent, David.
Wow.
So that was my introduction to ufology was, you know, I had heard the stories prior
right.
to that.
Right.
But standing there and seeing one come at you
right.
and move overhead,
mm-hmm.
you know that was not a helicopter mm-hmm. that just moved over. It was not a glider. It was not anything that we could figure out what it was.
Mm.
It did come back twice that night, but at higher elevations. And each time it moved into our airspace, the second and third time, it was being chased by some kind of military
was it?
Airplanes.
Yeah. Yeah, I hear that a lot, too. The first they see the object, and then it moves out, and here come the jets. And, oh, no, we don't chase them. We don't do anything. You know, that was, in my case, the Northern Lights. They said it was the Northern Lights. But like you say, when you're standing there looking at this object, and then the government comes along and tells you, you're looking at the Northern Lights, you fool. you understand that they're keeping this from you.
Exactly. Yeah. And we don't get that, of course, at every MUFON case, but I'd say every 20 or 30 or 40 cases somewhere, there is a statistic we could probably look up, but every once in a while, you get the, hey, we saw the object, and then within minutes, military intervention, or seemingly military
right.
intervention coming in.
Well, there.
I saw it myself firsthand, but mm-hmm. the military, of course, they don't investigate UFO cases.
Right. This was in 73, right? So they had closed Blue Book by then in 69. So
right.
did enough people see it, and did you report it or your family report it?
Yeah. In Pennsylvania, you may know the name Stan Gordon.
Yes. We had him on the show just
Stan,
a little while ago.
He's still on the job down here.
Yeah.
And I was 16 that year in 73. Mm-hmm. My father actually volunteered with Stan as a photographer to go out on some of these cases. Of course, we were being inundated not only with UFOs that summer of 73 into 74, but also the Bigfoot creature at the same time.
Right.
And little did I know that many years would pass, and Stan Gordon and I would get together, and I would be the editor on his book about what happened in 73, 74.
Mm-hmm.
And that book came out in, I'm going to say 2011, fall of Fall of 2010 or Fall of 2011. I forget which.
Now, what is the name of this book?
That book is called Silent Invasion.
Right. We talked about that. Stan was on my show just a couple months ago, and we discussed that. I did not know that you were part of that, though.
Yep. That was about a roughly three-year project for us. The last 2 years, very, very heavy. I was in Chicago at the time and did most of my work from there, but I made three or four trips out to Pennsylvania for a week at a time to spend time with him and, you know, trade notes while we were doing. But yeah, I was the editor on the book. And long time coming for him. Of course, he's the Kecksburg UFO crash expert.
Right.
But then he went on to just stay, you know, mainly a UFO investigator, but he got very caught up in the Bigfoot phenomena.
Yeah.
Also.
Yeah. Well, I'm beginning to believe that there is a connection between the Bigfoot phenomenon and the UFO phenomenon.
I'm right there too.
Yeah.
My third documentary is called Exploring Site 516, and that's a site about. I'm in southwestern Pennsylvania now, and that site is about 2 hours north of me.
Mm.
And they're a site that claims, you know, the Bigfoot creature as well as a lot of UFO activity. And there's a number of those cases around the country. Even our regular columnist, Ted Phillips, talks about Marley Woods every month.
Mm.
I don't know the location of that site, but that's a site heavy with creatures and UFO activity. Very similar to, you might recall, the Skinwalker Ranch.
Right.
Or what they call, you know, Hunt. The book was called Hunt for the Skinwalker.
Right.
Excellent title. But again, it mentions one particular ranch out west, very heavy with UFO activity. At the same time, the Bigfoot creatures being reported.
Mm-hmm. All kinds of creatures. You know, that's,
oh, yeah.
Yeah. It was Knapp that investigated that.
Yes.
Okay. So I need to take one more break just to remind our listeners that they're listening to WHFR.FM, the station making waves. And I'm David Twitchell, and you're listening to We Are Not Alone, and we're speaking with the editor of the MUFON Journal, Mr. Roger Marsh. And welcome back,
Roger. Thank you, David.
And so what do you feel is the direction? First of all, you had this sighting back in 73. With the presence of your family or other family members? Or?
I was actually probably about four or five blocks from my own home at the time. I was visiting with some cousins, first cousins.
Mm-hmm.
So they were outside. I would say there was probably a dozen kids in the street.
Mm.
There were some other adults. And then on the other end of our neighborhood, we live in a neighborhood about 300 homes.
Mm.
There were other people that were outside that saw the object go over. And I would say probably 50 or 60 of us got together that night on a neighbor's front lawn, and we kind of staked out the night for a few hours. And that's how we saw the object coming back for the second and third time. But yeah, quite a few people there. And then I didn't really realize it at the time. I don't even know if Stan Gordon understood it, but certainly by fall of 73, he knew that there was something was going on in Pennsylvania, because rather than getting two or three or four or five reports a month, he's getting hundreds of reports a month, all from a concentrated area.
Mm.
And as Stan loves to tell the story, that in Pennsylvania with the rolling hills, similar to probably Michigan where you're at, might have a hill that has two access roads, one on either side.
Mm.
So you could actually have neighbors that live pretty close to each other, but they don't know each other because they both use two different roads.
Mm.
One guy calls up and says, me and my family saw a UFO hovering 50 feet over our backyard last night at 9 p.m. 10 minutes later, the neighbor on the other side of the hill says, hey, at 9 o'clock last night, we saw three Bigfoot creatures standing in our backyard.
Mm-hmm.
And you draw a line from one backyard to the other, and it's about 300-400 feet. Just a they access from different roads. They don't know each other.
Right.
We had a lot of cases like that, of these creatures where, again, one person didn't see the creatures, but they saw an oval-shaped object coming down and hovering, you know, 20, 30 feet off the ground.
Mm.
Yet somebody in that same time period, a short distance away, saw the Bigfoot creature.
Right. So what was the official explanation, if any, for your sighting? Did you guys ever get any official explanation?
No, it's really the same as with MUFON today. I tell people that the best you ever get out of MUFON, or any investigator, is that your case is an unknown.
No.
Meaning that somebody at least tried to look at it to see if there was something natural about it or something man-made about it.
Right.
And once they've ruled all that out, and now you have this anomalous type of object, or an object that does not appear to be part of a man-made, you know, aviation arsenal, it just doesn't appear to be something that we have that can be totally silent and that can just sit there in the sky and just hover or move at right angles, you know. What do you do?
Right.
You simply stamp it unknown, you know, and you file it
so did,
away.
So did the government stamp it unknown, your sighting?
Well, no, at that time, I probably at 73 was probably unaware of MUFON.
No, not MUFON, but the government.
Dan Gordon was just, I know that at one time he was the state director for MUFON. I don't know if it was that particular year. But he was considered the local UFO investigator, and he really just could not offer up any explanation for it. Just, hey, it was an anomalous event
right. That
happened.
But that was...
I can't tell you the government was involved from the state level, you know, county, town, state police. They were very, very involved in moving all of these cases over to Stan Gordon, sharing data with them. So they were very helpful. Even state government paid him a visit.
So
they were somewhat alarmed, even at the state police level.
Okay.
There was a state policeman. It was a great case out of Uniontown, Pennsylvania. I believe that was October of 73, where a family saw like a saucer-shaped object coming down out of the sky, landing on their farm. So the son, who I think was a teenager at the time, jumped into a pickup truck with a couple of neighbor boys, and they drove up this hill where the object had landed down in like a little bit of a valley. So they were just right above it. And then when they looked down and saw the saucer, off behind the saucer where the field met like the wooded area, they saw two Bigfoot creatures. So the kid had a shotgun with him, and he fired a shot directly at this saucer that was lit up. And right as he pulled the trigger, the dang thing just disappeared right in front of their eyes.
My goodness.
But it left behind a ring of light on the ground. And later, when the state police, you know, came out to look at it, the state policeman actually said that you could read a newspaper off that light on the ground.
Yep.
And then the state police officer with the young man, you know, the son that had gone up, they then had an encounter with two Bigfoot creatures. And they ran from the scene, got into the squad car, and he took this guy back to his barracks, you know, back to the base.
Right.
And my understanding was that he left the state police after that. There might have been some amount of ridicule involved in that. I don't know. But it's in the book. It's a major case. So, you know, state, county, local officials were aware at that time, and they were alarmed enough to at least have meetings with Stan Gordon to try to figure out what was going on.
So in other words, they didn't
just as suddenly as it came in 73 and early 74, it just subsided. It's never completely gone away in this area. We still get UFO and Bigfoot reports, but, you know, maybe once or twice a month, not like hundreds of cases.
Wow. So, in other words, the government didn't try to say, oh, you saw the Northern Lights. You saw Air Force jets or...
Oh, no, absolutely not.
Yeah. Okay.
No,
so.
And I don't think, probably because we reported directly to Stan, he would have kept our identity, you know, secret at the time.
Yeah.
But I do know back in 73, 74, he does have a few stories where he went to a site and only those people knew and he knew, and within 24 hours, other people, investigators, identifying themselves as being with the government, did show up at some of these sites.
Mm-hmm.
And they did try to coerce people and tell them, no, you didn't really see that, or they tried to destroy evidence.
Uh-huh. So,
and I believe there was a hint of mail tampering with Stan, and probably, I think he believed his phone was being tapped back then as well.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah.
I don't know. What about you? Do you think your phone's being tapped? I hear a little.
I mean, a little breakup.
Pretty
on sophisticated this. Today to do it. I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
You know, pretty much everything I believe in and everything that I know is in print.
Yeah.
So it'd be kind of a waste of time. I'm not having secret phone calls with, mm-hmm. you know.
With me.
Men in Black, or with officials within MUFON. It's not like we know this other story is going on,
right.
And we're not letting the public in. So there's really nothing, and anything that I know is in print.
Yeah.
I push it right out there.
There's a joke. There's a joke about how they think that government officials are coming to MUFON meetings to find things out because we know more than they do. You know,
right?
So that may well be. Who knows? So something was mentioned about MUFON trying to put on develop a television show. What's that all about? Do you know?
Well, that actually happens from time to time. Companies mm-hmm. approach us, and they have ideas. And I know that we've been in talks with a lot of different companies. These are basically production companies who have ideas for sites, for shows, and they need a development deal. So I believe that last bit of information that you may have heard through MUFON, I don't know that we exactly have a show, but I know we did sign a contract with a production company with the intention of doing a show.
Mm.
And I believe that that just tied us up with them for a few months. I think that's ending pretty soon.
Really?
So if there's going to be a show, we should probably know about it in the next 2 or 3 months.
Well.
But I have not heard anything personally since the last time I inquired. It was still one of those development things, and usually that's rather time-consuming.
So you,
and
just...
you may not hear something for 3 or 4 months,
right.
And then it's, you know... either a green light or a red light.
Right.
It's usually a red light.
So somebody in one of our listeners has a sighting of something they can't explain in the sky, on the ground, whatever. What do they do? How do they let MUFON know? What's the procedure?
It's really easy, I tell people. It just takes a couple of minutes. If you go to MUFON.com, MUFON.com, you'll see a link on the homepage to report a sighting. I think it's in the upper right-hand corner. But report a sighting, and the form pops up. And you'll see on there's only a couple of areas. I think it's like a headline and a brief description of what happened. The public, anybody 24/7 can see that section. But all of the other sections to that report are confidential. It's for the field investigator only. And... again, nothing is released that you don't want released. It's all kept in there. But just takes a couple of minutes to fill out. And then depending on what state you're in, the state director is usually the one that then makes the assignment of your case, matches you up with a field investigator. So usually within 24 to 72 hours after you file, you'll probably get an email generally from your field investigator wanting to follow up.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And
very easy.
If you're in Michigan, I may be the one that calls you.
Oh, there you go.
It
varies from state to state how they set it up.
So if you guys want to talk to me, don't file any bogus reports. But if you see something, file a report with MUFON.com, right? So what do you see the direction of MUFON as an organization in the future?
Well, I'm hoping it looks like that's the direction we're going, where we could be an agency that probably helps more. Like, I believe we have a lot of content, David. We have a lot of information about cases. It's there for people to filter through some of it. Anybody can go to MUFON.com and look at what I call the public side of reports, which is, you know, generally the state and the date that the report was filed, the date of the incident, and a general description of it. But I think we could do a better job in the future of maybe offering the public statistics. I know that once a month we do let people know, you know, by shape, how many objects were reported, distance between the witness and the object, you know, things like that. But I think that we could probably be better organized in the future utilizing multimedia. And right now we have a great program underway, hoping to launch it by probably by July, by the annual symposium, which will be in Kentucky this year, by the way. It's a new website that will be interactive with the public and give you more up-to-date information about what we're doing. So I see us being, you know, using more multimedia in the future, getting more information up for people, and getting our name out there. I think that if you just crossed America today asking people, if you saw a UFO, where would you report it? 9 times out of 10, people are going to down 911.
Right.
And I do tell people, down 911 if you think you're in danger, definitely. Move away from the object, don't go toward it, you know, all the normal, you know, stuff.
All right.
But I think that's one thing our organization could do. We used to be, you have many, many more members than we have right now. We're fluttering right around 3,000 members nationwide. And we really should be around, you know, I'd love to see us around 40,000, 50,000 members. And I think we were probably closer to 20,000, you know, probably in the 70s sometime. We started up in, what, 69? And I think there was a nice rise. But I think once Project Blue Book closed down and a lot of government stories came out saying this is nothing, people started to lose interest and, you know, membership kind of waned there for a while. So I'm hoping that, you know, with the current leadership we've got right now, we've got some great people within MUFON, some great new people coming in that understand the use of multimedia, we'll be able to give more to the public.
Right. Well, we're international, too, as a matter of fact, aren't we?
Yes.
So
maybe
it's
some
not
growth
just
internationally also would be great.
Right. But we do have other countries. The MUFON is in other countries.
Yeah, you can see that from the monthly statistics. But, of course, you know, again, most of those reports are coming out of the U.S.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
We don't have a real strong presence, you know, in other countries. It varies, you know, country to country.
I get a lot of cases where they say they you know, they had this sighting back in the 70s or back in the 60s or whatever, and they say they're just getting around to reporting it now because they did not know who to go to, who to report this to.
Yeah.
And of course, they were afraid of ridicule, which a lot of people are. And they don't have to be with MUFON because you want to keep your name is always kept anonymous.
Right.
You know?
Yeah, you as the witness, you control that. If you want to talk to the media, that's fine. But if you do not want to be named or located, probably the closest we can name you is the county and state. You know, that's pretty wide open.
Yeah, the witness.
Other than that, yes, we will be very, very confidential about all the information we collect from you.
The witness is called the witness. Right.
Exactly.
Right.
Witness A, Witness B.
Right. So, Roger Marsh, where can people go to learn more about your work?
Well, most of my work, of course, is over at examiner.com, and you can go to examiner.com, and in their search engine, just type in the acronym UFO or my name, Roger Marsh, or just Google my name, Roger Marsh, and I'll pop up. Usually there's the first item there. But I would also try to convince people to come over to MUFON.com and join. Take out an annual membership, and you'll get the great monthly MUFON UFO Journal, which I'm editor of. Very proud of it.
Certainly.
I've gotten three of them out so far. I'm working on the March issue right now. So I'd love to see some of your listeners out there coming over and subscribing.
Yes.
And you could see the most up-to-date material in the journal.
Most up-to-date material what?
In the journal.
In the journal,
you'll see what's inside. Every month we have a STAR team investigation now. You're going to see part two in the March issue. We started, STAR team started a three-part series in the February issue. Lots of good stuff. You'll see my triangle reports from 2011. Part one is in the February issue.
I'm looking forward to it.
And a lot of great stories planned.
Right.
We always release the best material through the journal first.
Good.
But day-to-day writing, if they want to see what's happening around the country on any day, just tune into my material over at examiner.com.
Roger Marsh, thank you very much for joining us today. Hope we
thank
can do
you,
this
David.
Again.
Glad to be here.
Good. And if listeners have any questions or comments for me, you can email me at dtwitchell@hotmail.com. And this show, as well as all the forum shows, is now archived at WHFR.FM's website. Click on the forum button on the homepage. We Are Not Alone is also archived at my website, UFOImplications.com. Please stay tuned to WHFR.FM, the station making waves, for the best in alternative programming. And I want to thank you for joining us today. Please join us again the first Tuesday of each month at 1 p.m. when we will again explore the mysteries of the UFO phenomenon. And until then, this is David Twitchell reminding you to keep an eye on the sky.
Hey, this is Brian Vander Ark, and you're listening to my music on WHFR Dearborn.
Peace, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Righteous Knowledge, and I would like to welcome you all to the Smooth Soul Cafe. And ready to inject the soul back into your hearts is Darnell Kendricks.